You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Ken McLean. Ken, it's good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
So the way the show starts, Ken, is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the quality of life you aspire to live, the things you've done, the labels you wear? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Well, I'm a writer. I was a professor at Cornell for 40 years. I think that if I talked about myself, I'd probably say that I'm just someone trying to live decently and humanely and meaningfully in the world.
When did you realize that it's as simple as that?
I was very lucky because I grew up, interestingly enough, in a household where my parents, though they wouldn't have called themselves yet, were socialists, but they were very socially active. And in fact, I spent much of my young life in Adam Clayton Powell's house, Congressman Powell in New York City, which meant that I came in contact with some of the most important sort of civil rights icons in America. I was very young then, so we're talking about, I probably was no longer in touch with Congressman Powell when I was over 8, but it still meant that I saw Dr. King, I saw Duke Ellington, I saw all these people were there, right? And as a kid, the thing that you will remember is whether people were nice to you. And so I, in fact, have a Cashew Ditty written by Duke Ellington, which is one of the reasons I love his music. But more importantly, to have seen these people at a very important moment in terms of civil rights, even though I didn't understand much of it. One of the things that was, I think, essential to realize is that for people who involved in civil rights, every struggle was to them crucial. And so there was very little that they could take for granted. And hence, they would always, in some sense, be involved in one campaign after another. And both of my parents were very involved in that too. We used to have Freedom Riders stay with us for 2 weeks. And that taught me a great deal about what real courage is. And if you want to, I can talk a little bit more about Dr. King, who also stayed with us for an incredible 36 hours, which I've actually written about.
Right, right. Well, let's see where this goes. What I'd like to do now is to cut to music. You brought some music with you. What should we open the show with here?
Could you start with Nina Simone's I Like the Sunrise?
Every evening I wish upon a star. that my brand new tomorrow isn't very far when that heavy blue curtain of night is high in the sky.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Ken McLean. So Ken, I want to shine the spotlight on you, and you very humbly announced your role in the world and how you were around some of the biggest people in the civil rights movement and how they impacted you. But what I want to ask you is, question that I ask everybody, but I think it's a good place to start. What did you have to learn? What did you have to go through to know the life you value and to actually begin to know how to live it? What did you have to experience to know how to live the life you value now?
I think for me, it started because I grew up in Harlem and I was among the first two Black students to go to the oldest independent school in America. And that meant that I had to go from literally one ghetto to another. And that meant at age six that I had to very quickly understand who I was and what I in some sense needed to do. And interestingly enough, my parents said something to me, which I've also written about, and it's a very odd thing to tell a kid, but they told me that should anybody ever say anything to me about my race or should anyone ever call me stupid, I was to hit them. Now, my parents were not in any way, right, violent people, but the importance of that was it meant that I never in some sense took on that kind of self-loathing that some Black people, not everyone, very often, unfortunately, learn to accommodate themselves to. And in fact, I wasn't at the collegiate school more than 3 days when a young boy in the first grade called me nigger and I hit him right in the face and immediately was sent to the headmaster, or in this case, the headmistress. And it was really an incredible story because when I did this, the school was in some sense aghast and they brought in my mom. And it was so kind of a wonderful kind of discussion because the head of the lower school, Mrs. Yule, brought my mother in and poor Mrs. Yule was trying to figure out how to kind of broach the subject. And finally, my mother just looked at her and she said, Mrs. Yule, I know you didn't call me in here just to talk about, gardening or the kinds of things one could do in New York City. And then Miss Yule began talking about the fact that, there was this altercation and of course they wouldn't in some sense support what the young boy did, but that I had not acted in a way that a collegiate boy should. But before she even finished recounting what had happened, my mother said, Mrs. Yule, if my son did not hit that boy, both my husband and I would have been very displeased with him. So then she had to realize very quickly, right, that I was not the errant son, but I was the good boy, right? And in some sense, she had to understand that as it had taken 350 years to create the collegiate school, it had also taken 350 years to create Afro-American society. And we didn't necessarily thank them for their late trouble. We figured that we deserved to be at that school from the outset. And I think that's where it began very quickly to realize that not that I'm better than anybody, but I'm certainly as good as anyone. And I think that's where the moment of self-definition began. Of course, it continues on now. I am certainly always on a journey, but I think placing myself, I mean, I guess let me try it again. I think for me, just realizing, right, that I was moving from one set of customs to another set, seeing that in some, that relationship at age six said a great deal about my ability in some sense to define the world.
Right. And I guess one of where I would want to go into that a little bit more is that not only did you see it so very clearly, they invited you to take personal agency. And that personal agency is what got initiated with that first blow.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. The other thing is, remember that this school, if you can believe this, was founded in 1628. You know, for me to come there 335 years later was a, you know, it was an incredible announcement for all of us, for the school and for me, right? And it was a commencement in sorts of sorts. And it was messy. In fact, I hated the school. Much later, I was actually on the Board of Trustees. I just got off about 2 years ago. And I did that largely because I wanted to make certain that no student would suffer the way I did. And luckily, the school is infinitely better than it was, but it still has problems. And part of it is also that it's an all-male school. And frankly, I think in this day and age, and probably at its beginning, there's something very deformative about that. If you consider your school this place where, in effect, we teach the elite, and half of the world's population isn't included in that, there's something terribly deformative. And I think men who knew on some sense, boys who knew on some sense, that probably the smartest people in their family are very often their mother. It seemed very odd to be in a place like that, which just seemed to me dangerously narrow.
That provided a foundation. But as you have stepped out, you know, you have relationships with students, with family, spouse. What did you need to learn in addition to that sense of personal agency to know how to live the life you value now?
I think in some sense I had to realize, and I think everyone realizes this, and you know, you just have to realize that that person across from you is as complex as you are. I mean, you know, to sort of really understand that each of us wants to be valued, sees himself or herself as sacred, or hopefully does, right?
Or whole, or longing to be whole.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting when I was thinking about this, because there's a very early book by Gwendolyn Brooks called A Brownsville Mother Bird, a street in Brownsville, her first book. And it's an amazing book because it's really, even though it's a book of poems, it's really just about empathy. You know, it's about understanding. For example, she has a wonderful poem where she suddenly says, you know, it must be lonely to be God. And what she's saying is, you know, and she literally says, you know, where everybody in some sense is looking towards you or sees you as being great, but you yourself can't necessarily have a hand to hold, right? And I'm thinking about that. I mean, it seems to me that much of my life is trying in some sense to make certain that I am both, that I'm responsive in some sense to all of these people in some sense that mean a great deal to me, even if I don't know them. And I think that's probably why I'm a writer.
Right. Just because of the passion of your presence and your commitment to these issues, there's a difference between empathy and compassion. And empathy, we have to find a common experience. We have to find something that kind of connects us across. We have empathy for others. And that's a little bit of a straitjacket, especially if we don't perceive that an experience that we share in some way. But compassion is shared emotion, shared pathos, literally. There's a physical response when we see people that we choose to care about or that we are drawn to for reasons we do not know. There's that space between that empathy has disappears and we just relate to them directly, almost enter into a dance with them across differences where we don't have much of anything in common. Maybe does that resonate at all with you?
Yeah, I think though, for me, it's largely, I'm always conscious of the fact that every day, not meaning to, I demean someone, I prejudge them, I don't really see, in some sense, their level of suffering. And I always, in some sense, try to figure that out. And back to my schooling, I think what that school made me do very quickly is understand that I had to figure out not only who I was, but who other people were. Why did they take that position? Very often, in some sense, those people who do injustice to me very often don't understand their own entrapment. I mean, I actually do think most people, given the opportunity, although I must admit the election may not say that, but given the opportunity, would do the right thing. What's worrisome is when they wouldn't. But I think most people, if they could see a way to do it, if they could understand in some sense, right, that life presents all kinds of possibilities where one in some sense can corroborate others. And in some sense, you know, you can't face in others what you can't face in yourself.
Right, right. And the hurt and damage in the other and the hurt and damage that we've done to each other or to ourselves or to the other. One of the things that you have, what I experience you were a professor of mine 43 years ago. I doubt that you remember that student in your course one fall in 1977. You have a presence. And when your presence is open, people enter into some sort of curiosity. The key to compassion, I think, is presence more than trying to intellectually understand. Because when you're fully present, you feel and sense and react and wonder where these things come from. And a lot of times we overthink this stuff. Mm. That gets us in our ways and that gets us dug in politically as well as personally.
I think in some sense for me, even though I, by nature, am somewhat shy, I actually love people. I love them. I love the fact that I meet so many people, you know, who've confronted things like unimaginably, unspeakably complex things every day, you know, and I see in them that incredible generosity. And very often they sit there and they are worried about me and not the other way around. And it seems to me, you can't live in this world and see people, you know, one of the wonderful things of being at Cornell is you'd have students. I remember a class I'll never forget, and it was a course on it's called The Art of the Essay. And this was a beginning, you know, a freshman class. And there was a young Vietnamese student in this class. She was very, very articulate. And she wrote very beautiful papers, but they were largely safe papers. When I say safe, meaning they were about things, you know, she would write about playing the piano. She'd write very beautifully. And I'm not trying to anyway trivialize these papers. But other students who weren't necessarily as talented, I'm talking about in terms of the grace of their prose, often confronted things far more personally, it seems to me, important, crucial to their own development. And I remember we got to week 7, I'll never forget it. And all of a sudden she said to these students, she said, you know, I've been writing these safe papers, and she just volunteered this. And she said, but I feel that I owe you this. And then she wrote this paper, I will never forget it. And she wrote this paper talking about being in Vietnam, growing up when the bombers came over and literally killed her whole family. And it was an astonishing moment for me for a lot of reasons. First of all, the paper was just so powerful I really did not know what to say. And I also felt that this really, at this moment, in some sense, that almost anything I would say would seem, right, possibly callous or a trivialization of what she'd undergone. And I was really at a loss. And then my students, bless them, 201, they all stood up. I'm going to tear up now. All stood up, walked over her, and just hugged her. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, it is that in those moments, right, where you understand how incredibly wonderful community can be. Yeah. And had they not done that, I don't know what would have happened. But I guess I'm trying to feel that, for me, if you can get that level of trust, and I mean, I think you were very, very generous saying that you remembered me from 77. It's odd, you know, when I often give talks and stuff, and I will always write them out because I'm always afraid that I'll be completely tongue-tied. But when I give a talk, very often, if I'm not looking at the actual text, if you ask me what I said to the people, I couldn't tell you. I won't remember any of it. And this is not false modesty, it's just true. But I mean, in some sense, I just throw myself, you know, I think I'm very, very lucky. I mean, it seems to me that I get far more love than I frankly deserve. I, in some sense, throw myself at everybody's mercy.
Yes and no. You throw yourself. I have the same problem. Whenever anything is really true and rich and powerful, don't ask me what I just said. I could never reproduce it. It is an inspired form of speech. It has a cadence. It has an alliteration. It has all of those qualities, not because I chose to put them there, but because they came there. And they were drawn out of me as much as they were, as much as they came out of me. If you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the circumstance. Yeah. And to me, that it's in that thin space where we live compassion. And one of the, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but one of the things was you were an enigma to me. You grew up in relative affluence. I grew up in extreme rural poverty. One out of 20 of my peers wouldn't make it to the age of 20 because of drugs, alcohol, bad healthcare, police violence, all sorts of stuff. And here I am at an Ivy League college from Northwest Missouri. And you were so passionate and so engaged. And you said to me at one point, why do all of you try to write the whole of experience in one small sentence? You only earn that after years and years of writing. And that was just very, very powerful in terms of helping me both realize what I was trying to take on in life, but also realizing that it's a long walk.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you say that, because I was thinking that, you know, you are a testament to what is great when universities work, when it truly is the universe, right? Where all of these people, in some sense, who are variously impassioned, right, hopefully, in some sense, can find a way, not only in some sense to sort of champion their own voice, but in some sense to hear those other voices. And it is true. Again, I mean, you're a perfect example of what I'm talking about, is that I, you know, I guess the one good thing about me, if I have one good thing I could say, is that I went to all the right schools, I had all the right breaks. And yet, you know, I had a brother who died of alcoholism. I had a sister who didn't breathe for the first 7 minutes of her life and was relatively high functioning given that, right? I had a mother who was schizophrenic. And yet my parents loved me. They loved me. There was never a doubt in my mind, right, that they would in some sense champion me no matter what happened. And what that did for me, and I guess if I have anything good about myself, is I've always said to myself, you know, all I had to do was follow the bouncing ball and I'd be okay, right? And what bothers me, I think, and very often in elite institutions, is I'm so tired of hearing people say, oh, you know, how hard I worked. And I'm saying, what do you mean? There's millions of people who are infinitely smarter than I am, infinitely smarter than you are, right? Who never get a shot at this. All of us in these places has had someone who said, you matter. Right. When I teach, when I'm working at Auburn Prison, I'm working with people very often where no one ever said that they matter. Mm-hmm. Not one person. In fact, very often I'm sitting there and I am the first person, right, to suddenly say, gee, you're smart.
You're right? The first person. Yeah. You're the first person with academic credentials to say that.
Right, right. And if and that's really you, that's where you suddenly realize what this stuff can do. And we know, you know, that you can literally, right, credentialize somebody that they in some sense see in you. They believe more in us than we believe in ourselves.
And it's just really funny. Just life. My mother was mentally ill. I'm the seventh of eight children. I was born to replace a baby that died, that sent my mother into a massive break with reality. And her finding herself was having me in part. That is quite a little load to carry and to sort through. And so it helps me understand, because I felt a connection back then, but I couldn't name it. And the race issues and the cultural issues, and you were a professor and I was a second semester, a third semester student. It's just interesting how all of these things.
Well, you know, it's funny when you say that. I've been working on a new book, and one of the essays is about my mother. And I've published two books of memoir, and I've never really talked about my mother. I mean, she's there, but I never talked about how incredibly difficult her life was. And yet she was, again, I mean, I've never met anyone who was more generous. I mean, she was always doing everything for everybody else and incredibly brilliant. I mean, she went to Girls Latin in Boston. She was a salutatorian at Massachusetts College of Pharmacy, and she never practiced a day in her life. She didn't want to be a pharmacist. You know, her stepmother tried to kill her. I mean, it's just one thing after another. And yet my mother never, I mean, I know this stuff, but she never talked about it, you know? You know, life is really, really hard for many people. And it seems to me, those of us in some sense who are allowed to see people who really in some sense measured up in ways that are almost impossible, right, to fathom, really in some sense need to sing these people's praises. I guess that's why I like to write. I mean, I like to make the cases for people who for whatever reason can't make their own case.
Yeah. Ken, let's cut to music. What should we play next?
Yeah, let's go up. Let's do Retrospection by Duke Ellington. There's a lot of Ellington here today, I've noticed.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Ken McLean. Surprise and change. These are the two themes for this segment.
You know, it's interesting. This is going to sound very odd. I can't really say that anything that I've confronted particularly surprised me. I think in some sense, as you can tell, I'm a romantic, and to that, and somewhat elegiac for that reason, I think. So that my sense is the things that surprise me are when life turns out better than you would think.
And that's, you know, one of the things that I'm looking for.
Yeah.
So you're kind of fated for the other, but it turns out better.
Yeah, I mean, that's, for me, that's it. I mean, in some sense, I consider myself incredibly lucky. And very often I've done things that in retrospect were probably pretty crazy, and may in fact suggested a certain level of hysteria. But let me give you a more sort of clear example of this. When I came to Cornell as a freshman, and I didn't really know, I knew what I wanted to do. I mean, I had a real good sense of what I wanted to take. Probably many students felt that, but I really did. I knew what I needed to know. And I remember I met with an associate dean or assistant dean or something, and she told me that I had to do blah, 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 blah. And I was really angry. I mean, this is not something I'm necessarily proud of, but I was incredibly peeved by talking to her. And I was so angry that I literally left her office and went across the hall, right? And walked right into the dean of the college's office, right? And the secretary was there. Remember, this is 1969, right? The fall of that year. So this is right after the Willis Straight Hall takeover, okay? And as everyone knows, I'm black, right? And the secretary is sitting there, and I literally look at her, and I just used an expletive. I said, let me speak to the smash dean, just like that. And I realized as soon as I said that, that I hadn't thought beyond that. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It was just pure, unadulterated, right, sort of anger, sort of a need, all of it. And interestingly, I did it, and you could see very quickly, right? I watched the secretary, and she's saying, oh my God, what's gonna happen here, right? And then I turned to my left, and there is someone sitting there. And the person sitting there happened to be an associate dean. And he very quickly, he saw this and he said, oh my goodness, let me handle this, right? Let me see what's going on here. Because they didn't know, they probably thought I was gonna, you know, I could do almost anything at that point. I looked like it, I was probably hysterical enough. And he said, excuse me, young man, how can I help you? Talk to me, what's going on? And he starts to speak to me, right? Very quickly, he suddenly says, well, you know, you sound like an ideal candidate for the College Scholar, which is a program they had in the college, which would allow you, in effect, right, to do anything you want. You had no requirements, but the swimming requirement, and you could take a course at any level, right? As long as the professor said yes, right? Right? And I got into that program and my whole life changed. But the reason I bring that up is perfect case of me lucking out. Frankly, they probably could have dismissed me from the school from the way I responded to the dean in the first place. I mean, I really lucked out. And this has happened time and time again. Now, it is true that I have a lot of sort of stuff in the kind of emotional bank. So people probably permit me a certain level of slippage. But time and time again, right? I've had these moments where I, in effect, do things that are really not particularly prudent, right? And up to this point, knock wood, I've always landed on my feet, but that's largely because people in some sense have celebrated me, you right. know? And I don't, and one of the reasons I think I do much of the work that I do is I realize that I'm there, but for the grace of God goeth I. I mean, frankly, I mean, there are many times when I, in some sense, voluntarily, right, put my head on the chopping block. Many of the people I work with, it wasn't voluntary.
Right. And there is, even when you are reacting in that way that you don't fully control, you're still making choices about it.
It's true.
And the raw directness of who you are becomes very obvious, and people can choose to step up or step back.
Well, I will say that if you think about it, whatever else I have, I do have a real sense of self, you know, and it's a kind of, and a sense of certain level of arrogance. And I lay that at my school in some levels.
Right, but also you also can play with it, and if you really can play with it, we share something. I was identified as one who didn't fit the boxes, so I became a college scholar in 1970s spring of 1977, and I was told by many of my professors, we didn't think you would make it to the age of 30, because I came from a rural cooperativist kind of left wing. Kind of, we took Black Power seriously, but from a poor white perspective, and it didn't matter because all of our power, we all needed power. Sure. You know what I mean? And sure. It didn't matter whether you called it black or white, because everybody needs the power to live the lives they seek.
Sure.
And so that's kind of where I came out of. And in the 1970s, this country was turning right in a hard sort of way, and there wasn't much space for that, especially rural whites. Mm-hmm. The my spiritual ancestors were leaders in the agrarian revolt of the 1870s and 80s, and they had mixed race congregations, and they didn't believe in a lot of professional class stuff. They wanted to control the railroads and the banks. Anyway, those were the people behind me, generations whose stories I only learned much later. Anyway, so it's interesting. I was also, as an undergrad, asked to write a letter for your tenure.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and it was one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me as a student, because I wasn't very happy at Cornell because I didn't fit real well, and I didn't know how to try to make it work until I took on David Greenwood as an advisor and figured a few things out.
You know, let me just first say that, sure. That, well, thank you for doing it, but also... No,
but that was it was to be asked was huge for me as a human being.
Yeah. Well, again, I think, you know, I think that one of the wonderful things about that time, right, is that we all felt, right, that we could matter.
Right.
We might not matter at that moment, but we knew, put it this way, we knew that we ought to matter.
Right.
Right? We were darn well going to make certain that that happened. Essentially, when you said that, you know, I want to talk about a kind of level of responsibility that I'll never forget. And when you mentioned the thing about letters, I hadn't talked to anybody about this. I remember I knew Audre Lorde. I wasn't a very close friend, but I knew her well enough so that we would talk every now and again. And I remember she called me. This was very late in her life. As you know, she died of cancer, but she calls me with that wonderful voice of hers, and I won't try to emulate it, but she called, she said, Ken, and I could hear her talking from probably, I think she was in St. John's, but she called, she said, Ken, the department has asked me to write a letter for you, and I need to know whether it's important, is it crucial to you? And I realized that I didn't know what the letter was about. I wasn't up for tenure or anything, so I didn't know anything about it. And I said, well, Audrey, my guess is it's important, but in all honesty, I don't know what it's about. And then she said something, and think about this. She said, Ken, she said, the reason I'm asking is I really can't do anything that's trivial. But if it's important, I'll do it. And I've always thought about that. I said to myself, this is a true, not a humanist, but a true teacher in the best sense of the word, right? I mean, that she was not going, she was in some sense literally dying, right? And she had every reason to say no. Most people I know have far less reason not to do stuff, and they're saying no all the time. You know, and I guess what I'm trying to say is that kind of level of measuring up seems to me so important, you know? And it's so often a situation where somebody, you know, one of the things that you know this, probably much better than I, but very often that little thing you do, even sometimes just smiling somebody, can be life itself.
A small kindness is not at all trivial.
It's real.
You got it. The experience at Cornell that wounded me, was I ran for University Senate upon days of arriving as a hayseed from Missouri. And I won in a field of like 10 candidates. I won with 49% of the vote. So I was very proud of this little accomplishment for this kid from Missouri. But they abolished they abolished the Senate the next spring when Rhodes was appointed, because that was the condition of his appointment.
Really?
One of the conditions was that they abolished this university-wide Senate that controlled the non-academic budget of the university. And then they set up the other things, and the trustees took more control. And the Senate had been created in the aftermath of 69 when you arrived. It wasn't a very old creature, but I came out of a democratic participatory democracy roots, and that was like a severe violation. And I wasn't old enough to understand that you have to take some hits like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny when you say that. You know, I remember when I and others were involved in the divestment movement.
Yep.
This was 87. And I remember when the university decided that they were going to arrest us and they were going to try to prosecute us for criminal trespass, not just civil trespass.
Right.
And the one thing my parents always said to me was that we don't care what you do, but don't get yourself thrown out. Right. And the fact that the university at that moment was willing to take all of us, right, and in effect make certain that we could never vote. Think about that, which is really kind of complicated when you're a person of color, but it's complicated for anybody, right? And I guess back to a question you asked before, that was the first moment where up to that point, because, you know, I had hated my high school so much, Cornell was like wonderful. You know, it was the first place that had taken me seriously. It told me that I was smart, this kind of stuff, right? And then all of a sudden it was willing in some sense, right?
To cut you off.
Cut me off, yeah. And that, I mean, in some sense, that's when I grew up.
Yep.
You know, and the good thing about that is I will never trust institutions again.
Yep.
At least not like that.
Institutions provide the scaffolding that we have to have to build the lives that we need over the long haul, but they also the same scaffolding from which we'll be lynched if we do not fit.
Yeah, that we will, in some sense, we always, maybe just, you know, just one needs to always be wary.
Yeah.
Right.
We have to have them, we can't live without them, but we.
Yeah. But do not, you know, again, it has its, an institution has its own life. It's not necessarily yours.
Ken, let's cut to music.
Yeah. Okay, let's do Thelonious Monk, Ugly Beauty, which has a great title.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Ken McLean. How have you learned to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, intellectually, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, throughout the year? How have you learned to take care of yourself? And when do you know you, what do you do? And when do you know you need to do it?
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say this, that I have a wonderful wife who's infinitely kinder, smarter, and resourceful than I am. And she's in some sense the reason that I'm at all together, coherent. And she really does keep me level. Luckily, I run, and I've been running since 1977. I run 5 days a week, not quickly, but I run with a guy. I've been running with the same guy now for, I think, 25 years. So we started at 5:30 in the morning, and we've done it forever, right? And he and I discuss politics all the time. I mean, we have probably murdered millions of people in our daily peregrinations. Yeah. So that's really a help. I mean, it keeps me, first of all, it gives me a schedule, blah, blah, blah. You know, particularly when it gets really dark and cold, you know that this guy is coming down the hill, right? And you're not going to leave him out there. The other thing is the person I run with is an engineer. And that's kind of magnificent, as my wife is also a scientist. And that's kind of wonderful to be with someone who is far more clear in a very different way than I am. So it's nice to have that kind of sounding board, right? Someone in some sense who can help you understand that the world in some sense can be seen in different ways. So that the physical stuff is great. The other thing is, I must admit, I can become very sort of a little bit, not sort of remote, and that I have to worry about. I mean, I can kind of like not see people for long periods of time. And I read a great deal, and that's fine. It's probably not healthy. And in fact, many times, a lot of the things I do because it would be very easy for me not to see anybody. And I actually do things to get myself out of the house and to do things so I don't, in some sense, don't become afraid of things, right? Because it becomes very convenient in some sense. And I think it's probably true for a lot of people of my ilk. COVID is horrible, but our lives had pretty much been like this in terms of being sort of shut-ins well before this. The only difference is now is that you worry about people who are out there. And you also, being a shut-in should not be some way of, in some sense, dealing with the fact that that there's a true plague out there.
Right.
So anyway, I guess for me, it's just largely, you know, sort of knowing what I need. And the other thing is, I really do need, I listen to a lot of music, and more importantly, I just get a great delight I'm a real people watcher. I just love looking at people, you know, and I learn a lot from just their faces and stuff. And when I can, I just go out and look at people. And it's kind of, for me, it's just kind of wondrous. And I just try to figure out, you know, what goes on there in that cerebellum.
You mentioned your wife.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't just mention her. But that kind of strong emotional connection in relationship, but also when did you learn that you may need to work or you may need help working against your tendency to isolate? When did you figure that out?
Good question. I would probably think it started, I want to say maybe 25 years ago. Yeah. Before I was in some sense more outgoing. Part of that, I think also, to be truthful, is that one of the weird things about university life is very often people you rely upon leave.
Yeah.
You know,
they leave or they die.
So you get, your tendency is, and you don't mean to, but sometimes you actually cut yourself off from, because you just don't want to invest as much. And that's kind of unfortunate, right? In people, because they may not be there.
So you got hurt.
Yeah. When I say I got hurt in the kind of, not so hurt personally, but you know what I mean? It's sort of like, you just got used to, in some sense, living a little bit more provisionally, let's say, maybe. But again, also, I think that you know, so much of, and this is probably true with most people, so much of my life at the university initially was just, we were doing so much in terms of politics and things. We were really involved. And we also, I mean, you know, departments change a lot. Those of us in creative writing, man, we used to do these incredible readings. We bring in people for all this stuff, and we do it on a budget of $25, you know. Everybody go to a Chinese restaurant, you know. Now we've got all this money, right? And we get all these people coming, but you don't have the sense of camaraderie. The world is slightly different, you know. I'd like to be back to those days, you know, where the kind of days where, remember, you know this, when people would all meet, right, at Moosewood. And there'd be Grace
Temple Paley, of Zeus.
Right, Temple of Zeus. There'd be Grace Paley there. You know what I mean? Those were the days. And again, I think it's easy to sort of romanticize that stuff, but it actually was romantic, you know? It was really kind of wonderful.
And many of us had memories of community where we meet each other as equals. Doesn't matter what your status is. There is no structure. There is no organization. There is no rule. There are no rules in a real community. Otherwise, it's an organization and or an institution. And I think we have lost the practice of cultivating that kind of open space and open heart. And you can have them on the sides of institutions, but it takes, you have to be intentional about it, and people need to feel that they can trust it.
You're absolutely right. I ran into Claire Grady a couple of days back. I think there are people in the world, right, who just add to it, and there are people who take, and she just adds. I've never seen anybody in my life who I think better exemplifies what it means to be generous and generative, right? I mean, and I was thinking about that. I said to myself, my goodness, right, to in some sense, do what she does, you know, and run the gamut of run the risk of being put in jail for, you know, for many, many years. And yet to never judge those people who do not do what she does harshly. It's kind of incredible. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, man, when you see people like that, it reminds you of your own potentialities. And we are very, very, very lucky to be in a place where there are many people like that who do what they need to do and just seem to have the gumption to do stuff. And they just get up and do it. And you're one of them too. I mean, yeah.
I interviewed Claire. She talked about what it was like for me to take on the whole town where I grew up in when there were so many deaths of my peers and what happened to me in terms of a physical attack and in terms of being taken on. And she understood immediately what that was about. And she understood how, when I was 17, 18, when that happened, how that can really set you up for some real difficulty down the road unless you find ways to put it in perspective. And that level of empathy, and there was truly empathy, but also compassion, incredibly powerful.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you, because you brought it up with Claire as an example, where do you see your life taking you in the next few years? What is the act of generosity or the desire? Where do you want to be present? Where do you want to show up in the world in the next few months or years?
Okay, there's two things I want to do. This is going to, on the kind of really small level, I have a book that I need to finish, and I need to finish it because it is, I hope, going to say things not about myself, but about others that need to be said. That's one part, but that's the easy part. Actually, you know, it's interesting, and I really want to get back to working with the guys in prison. One of the things that's been so astonishing to me is that you know this, but one of the things that's very complicated about teaching in prisons is that your relationship with students, especially at maximum security prisons, is very circumscribed. You cannot contact them after your class is over. And that's complicated, of course, because you do have relationships with people, right? But one of the things that happened with me, because I'm working on the magazine, I get to see some of these guys for longer than just my class, even though our relationship obviously is only related to the magazine as well it should be. But one of the things that I found happening is that it literally took for many of these guys 2 years to tell me what they had done. Now, and I will never ask. I mean, I didn't want to know. But what was so incredible was I realized that they literally were trying to protect me. They were trying to protect my naivete, right? And that, again, this incredible realization on my part of how enormous, right, their capacity in some sense for a kind of generosity. I mean, they were worried. They didn't want to tell Ken McLean what they had done. Well, one, for a self-serving reason, I would guess, that is, you know, I might not be able to teach them or even be able in some sense to appreciate them if I knew that someone had done something unspeakable. There's that part. But I think it was also that they just did not want to problematize my life any more than it already is. And there's something so incredible about that.
Right. The
same thing was also true, interestingly enough, with these guys when I had a very, very wonderful teaching assistant with me. And I was very worried because she was incredibly, she was very, very diminutive. And you know, I'm saying to myself, you know, these guys have been locked up for 30 years. Good God, you know, I don't know what's going to happen here. I hope they take her seriously. And the strangest thing was happening. They were incredibly solicitous. I mean, and it wasn't false. It wasn't, they didn't go over, but they took her seriously. But there was none of that kind of odiousness you see from most men. In fact, they were the epitome. In fact, I've never seen men in some sense more responsive and responsible, right?
And grateful, and
seeing somebody and realizing in some sense how perilous her situation is too,
right?
You know, and again, I guess that's the stuff that really interests me. There's nothing more powerful than seeing people in some sense in their complexity,
right? I'm going to say, when you say the word see, I'm going to say there's nothing more wonderful than to experience them. Not just, I mean, to see them in the way that you behold them.
That's right. Yeah. Well, again, I think the thing is, I believe we're in the world to co-evolve. Each of us, in some sense, has something to teach. One of the things that it's fun, I very often I'll meet people and you know, I guess to me, there's nothing more moving than talking to somebody and realizing how much, in some sense, how rich they are, right, in experience, right? And this isn't romantic. I mean, just how much they can tell you, right, about what it means to be present at their lives and, in some sense, at your life. That's one of the, Jimmy Baldwin has this great book, has many great books, but I love this book called Another Country, and because he talks about this guy, Rufus Scott, who actually commits suicide in the first 90 pages of the book, which makes the book an incredible book, largely because everybody, what Baldwin is sort of setting out, right, is this idea that if someone dies, it is everybody in the community's fault. It is a rift in some sense, right, that the whole community in some sense has to share. And I've been thinking about that because there's a line in there where this character is looking at another character and he just wonders, he just wonders if this character had ever really ever been, this is a direct quote, present at his life, you know, and I guess my sense is that sense of being present, right, is the sense of being both able in some sense, right, to witness what's going on, right, but also to be vulnerable in such a way, right, right, that it is almost daunting. You got to be able to be in a position where you, in some sense, really, in some sense, can be changed. That's hard. I guess that's what I want to keep, in some sense, knowing my limitations and trying to work on them. And I've got many.
Ken, it's great to get to know you.
Listen, I am so delighted that you were in my class, and I'm so delighted you're in the world.
What should we close the show with?
Let's do This Nearly Was Mine, which is about as romantic as you can get.
Thank you, Ken.
It's been a delight. Thank you.